Nice. I'll be the judge of that. Speaking of real art, I finished the Ibsen play. Thanks for the recommendation. I loved it. Right? It's so good. Fucking Doll's House. So brutal and honest. She nodded. Definitely. It feels so modern, the feminism in it. I know, right? But also surprising that a man wrote it. Shh. Save it for another time. Movie's starting. I pecked her on top of her head, her French braid still smelling faintly of shampoo. Oh, Byron asked at band practice if... But Molly shushed me again before I could invite her to the show, and I changed my mind. She probably wouldn't enjoy it, and I didn't want the crew to meet her and then later reduce her to tits and ass and the predictable blowjob potential, which they would have done. Our relationship felt private, and I wanted to keep it for myself. If Norman Rockwell had painted an idyllic romance between a punk rock Vietnamese kid and an Irish Catholic girl, we were that post cover. We spent weekends watching movies on the couch or debating books, movies, and music in a booth at one of the many truck stop diners that dotted Route 11. We talked endlessly over fries steaming with gravy, ordering more cups of coffee to rent our table for another 45 minutes. Lovebirds, late-night hawks at the diner, conjuring the most magical, grandest ideas that we could summon. There was a purity, an innocence that I didn't want defiled or sullied by my friends who sexualized everything and everyone. And even among my friends, there was developing a complexity and nuance for our punk scene. I saw change in all of us. Our definition of what was and wasn't punk was evolving, and we would need to evolve with it, or we would be choked by it. The crew couldn't allow ourselves to be ostracized by our own punk fundamentalism. We'd been together too long and been through so much. We were brothers in arms, besieged and beset. At the end of high school, my needs and interests had grown and changed, but all of our friends were intellectually and emotionally in different places and wanting different goals. Thankfully, my friends were my friends, and we cheered one another on, regardless of how we dressed, what we listened to, and what our other goals were, besides getting drunk and going to shows. The rednecks and jocks were still dicks, and we still had to stick together. By a wordless decree, we chose one another and supported our friendship, celebrating whatever we were doing, whether it was the military or the university or the mediocrity. Did the crew care that I was the editor of the paper, editor of the literary magazine, a member of Quiz Bowl and other nerdy shit? They didn't. Instead of getting shit about it, I got a nod and a fuck yeah, I'm glad one of us got in there, as if I were a double agent. To them, the punk rock fook was the authentic fook, and the nerdy bookish fook was doing what he had to do to infiltrate the system, a punk rock Trojan horse snuck in behind the ivory walls of academia. I had recently written an editorial that satirized the desire to be cool, mocking the pursuit of popularity, and my friends read it as a social grenade hurled across enemy lines. Dude, first the racism editorial and now this? You are fucking shredding on people. They were right. I was on a rampage, but it was in every direction. Sarcastic shrapnel hurled indiscriminately by an insecure boy who wanted so badly to belong and to feel that he was achieving greatness. March, 1991. I found out that I was waitlisted at UPenn, but I didn't call or write the university to say that I wanted to matriculate there. It was called the waitlist, not the beg list. I didn't know whether my alumni interview had helped me or not, and the UPenn waitlist was hopeful enough for me to keep my big city dreams bustling. I got into Penn State. While I was relieved that I would be going somewhere, I was indifferent to the prospects of the biggest state school in PA. My parents and Lou roundly congratulated me for my first college acceptance. But then, I got a large white envelope from NYU the next week. It was after school and I tore it open, and I saw the word, congratulations. I had gotten into NYU. I called everyone, did a crazy dance. That whole celebratory montage that you see on TV when someone hits the jackpot. NYU was my first choice, far beyond UPenn, and I was finally heading to the city. I told Mrs. Krebs and Mrs. Romberger at school and thanked them for their support, and they hugged me in congratulations. NYU's a great school. You're going to love New York. You think New York is ready for you? Mrs. Krebs beamed, and in her accolades, I was radiant, knowing that I had attained some measure of greatness, that the college application process validated it. But the celebration was short-lived. 2 weeks later, my parents sat me down, the purple NYU folder splayed out in front of them. My father resuscitated his long-dormant law degree to make their case, dispassionate and impartial. They'd done the math and scrutinized the financial aid. The numbers did not lie, and I wasn't supposed to take it personally. The mathematics of it said no, even as my emotions wailed, "Why?" "Fup, we can't afford NYU. They didn't give you enough financial aid, and we still need to plan for Lou's college in 3 years." The blows were mercifully short because of how volatile my parents' relationship was with me, a powder keg that could be ignited with a few sharp words sparked against fragile egos. My father was monotonous and direct in his delivery, just the facts. I couldn't be mad at Lou, but I felt no ripples of emotions or empathy from my parents. "At least you're still going to Peng State. Can't I take out loans?" Holding out for some sleight of miracle, some financial three-card Monty, my chest heavy at the news. I couldn't look at my father in the kitchen, me sitting in my seat, him sitting in his. This was where he had tried to kill me with scissors. For a moment, I wished that he had succeeded. My disappointment was so unbearable. "You don't want to graduate college with so much debt. It will be terrible for you. And if you default on your loan, we will have to pay it." Classy of him to assume that I would default on my debt. "Jesus, Dad, I won't default on the loan." "Don't say God's name in vain." That was all my mother said as they were immolating my NYU dreams. Not take God's fucking name in fucking vain. "We can't co-sign for you." "Can't or won't?" I wondered. It was semantics. I mumbled a weak assent. I had told everyone at school, my peers, the crew, my teachers, that I was going to NYU. Molly gave me a card to congratulate me, writing in purple pen, "NYU will be so lucky to have you." Everyone told me what a great school it was. Everyone told me how they saw me fitting right in New York City. Fitting in. That was the dream. And, in addition to not going to NYU, I now had to tell everyone that we were too poor to afford it. Some group, somewhere, some committee with the power of admission had decided that I was great enough to get in, but not that great, or at least not as great as I had hoped I was, and the public backtracking was humiliating for me. My father concluded, "We can look at Bard's financial aid if you get in, but at this point, it'll be Peng State unless Bard is the same price. Then you can decide." I nodded and left the table wordlessly. I didn't have tears for this disappointment. Crying seemed a small measure for getting into the college of my dreams but not being able to pay for it. Crying would change nothing. In my room, I looked at the Penn State paperwork, the brochure, the statistics. Tens of thousands of kids, all smiling, wearing their Nittany blue and cheering on the football factory that was Joe Paterno's Nittany Lions. Penn State's size, its student body, was epic, and their winning legacy was legendary. But football and a campus that worshipped sports with papal reverence? That didn't seem ideal for me, but it was a pill that I could swallow. I had hoped for something bigger and better after Carlisle. Penn State only seemed bigger. I looked at Bard's brochures again. The course catalog had interesting classes. 1,000 students, that was even smaller than Carlisle High School. I re-examined the tagline for the brochure. A place to think. I didn't get a sweaty whiff of sports or jocks or anything like that. The team mascots were the Blazers, whatever the hell that was. Bard didn't even have a logo. Unlike Penn State's slicked-back lion head, between Bard and Penn State, it seemed like a no-brainer. And I remembered Bard's top 10 scholarship. It would cost me the same as Penn State if I were in the top 10 GPA of my class. The next day, I stopped by the guidance counselor's office. "Hi there. Could you tell me what my class rank is?" "Do you need an official transcript?" "Oh no, just my class rank. My last name is Tran." A secretary shuffled about in a filing cabinet, pulled out a manila folder, and jotted a number down on a scrap of paper, sliding it across the counter as if it were unseemly to say it aloud, like a chlamydia test result. I looked at the square scrap for a moment, thinking of the 10 numbers that would guarantee me state school tuition at Bard. I panicked. What if I were number 10? Did being number 10 mean that I was still within the top 10? Or did 10th place mean that I was not within the top 10? Did the scholarship say in or within? It couldn't possibly mean within, could it? I thought about Casey Kasem's top 10 lists, MTV's top 10 lists, which always included numbers 1 through 10. I was overthinking it. This was stupid. Of course, even 10th place would be top 10. But it didn't matter, because I turned the paper over and saw the number 14. The 14th best GPA in a class of 313. Fucking fuck. Without top 10 GPA status, Bard's tuition would not be as affordable as Penn State's tuition. I would have to go to Penn State. I kept this information all to myself, allowing the aura of NYU matriculation and the UPenn waitlist to halo myself with the corona of supposed greatness. It felt good for people to think that I was going to NYU, that I was a good student, even if the perception was a shanty, bundled together with half-lies and wholehearted hopes. April 1991. During last period AP Calculus, Mr. Drake burbled in over the intercom to make an announcement. "I'm pleased to announce that the class of 1991 has voted for its graduation speakers. Congratulations to the following students: Matt Crum, Sam Miller, Latrice Hebron, and Phuc Tran." Holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. I tried not to smile. I thought it would have looked arrogant, but an irrepressible smile broke my stoicism. Whoa, oh man. Everyone in the room clapped and smiled at me. Greg turned around in his seat to shake my hand. "All right, Tran man, congratulations." He was beaming as brightly as I was shining inside. I tried to not let my classmates know how much it meant to me, but they could all see it from the look on my face. I felt exposed, but in their recognition, they caught me and held me up. It was the affirmation I had wanted. This was my Luke Skywalker getting his medal moment. "Thanks, Greg. I'm really surprised." "Surprised? No way. People love you." Greg said it so quickly. I was sure he didn't even think about it, but those words, "people love you," spread over me in a molten flow, warming every extremity. People loved me? Could I let myself believe it? The people had spoken and voted and loved. They wanted me to speak at graduation. My heart was buoyed by Greg's sincere excitement for me. My head was full of nothings for the last few minutes of class as the announcement about graduation speakers was still replaying itself in my mind. I had hoped, wildly dreamed, that in my most far-flung aspirations, the senior class would vote for me to speak for them. And they had. I would walk up on that stage and command the microphone for a few minutes. Me, the kid who had started out in this country with one shoe and a weird name. I was going to be a graduation speaker. In my fog, I forgot to write down the homework assignment and was slow to pack up my books. Mr. Cook pulled me aside as kids trickled out of class. "Hey, Phuc, I knew you'd be one of the speakers." He pumped my hand and grinned. "Thanks, Mr. Cook." My face tightened as though tears were imminent. He kept pumping my hand for a few moments after we stopped talking, smiling widely. If my election as graduation speaker was an Achilles moment, My conversation with my father was an Agamemnon moment. At dinner that night, breaking from my usual routine of sharing nothing with them, I told my parents about being elected to be a graduation speaker. My mom didn't fully understand the honor or the validation of it, but she did her mom thing. "That's great, honey," she Vietnamesed. My father was mid-chew, dipping some beef into hot sauce. "Oh, so you'll give a speech?" "Yeah, I'll be speaking at graduation." "Why you?" I could tell he was asking to annoy me, but I wasn't going to be goaded into an argument with him. I was not going to let him have power in this moment. "Well, I'm the editor of the newspaper. Maybe they think I have something to say." "And do you? Do you have anything to say?" He kept eating, shoveling rice into his mouth, his comments tossed off haphazardly. "Well, I have to think about it." I was starting to get annoyed. "You can't think of anything for your speech?"
"I will, Dad. Oh my God, just forget it."
I regretted bringing any of it up and stuffed my mouth full of beef and bok choy. His only power was to aggravate me, and I was not going to let him have it. My father wouldn't let it drop. "How many other kids are speaking?" "Four. Well, four kids in the valedictorian. Just forget it."
"So five? That's a lot of speakers. Who's the valedictorian? Not you, right?"
His tone implied that it wasn't special to be one of the five speakers, and he reminded me that I was not the valedictorian.
"Jacob Royal, he's the valedictorian."
Lou jumped in.
"What's a valedictorian?"
My father cut me off before I answered. "The best student in the graduating class." I shot back. Good grades don't necessarily mean that he's the best student.
Lou looked at me. "So you got voted to give a speech even though you're not the valedictorian? That sounds pretty good to me."
I nodded. "Thanks, Lou. I'm really excited." I didn't want to say anything more about it at dinner, given how my father was shitting all over my moment of greatness. I had brought up being graduation speaker because I wanted to share it with my family. Why? Because no matter how alienated I felt from my parents, I kept returning to a deep and undeniable need for their praise and approval. What would have made being graduation speaker better? Knowing that my parents were proud of me, really proud, and feeling that they really saw me. It was a gamble I took, and I was poorly rewarded by my mother's reflexive praise and my father's cutting inquiry. Another failed connection for our history books. After dinner, I sat in my bedroom and made some notes about my speech. I wanted to deliver a great one. That much I knew. I assumed that this was my first and probably last moment to address so many people, and the graduation speech had to be my best effort. I had to seize my moment of greatness, my aristeia. Aristeia in ancient Greek means moment of greatness or moment of being the best. In the Iliad, there are countless episodes where a warrior has an aristeia. Video game kids would call this beast mode. It's the highlight reel of battle, full of lopped off limbs and gnashing of teeth and another foe biting the dust. It was a manifestation of what I yearned for, my peers' recognition in the spectacle of a singular feat, a synthesis of greatness and accolades. My graduation speech was going to be my aristeia. I came home from the gas station on Wednesday evening, and my parents and Lou were waiting for me at the kitchen table. Surprised, I immediately scanned my conscience for what I was in trouble for. Still such a long list, but that inquiry stopped quickly. "You got mail from Bard College." My father's accent, the difficulty of switching from D to C, made a phonetic funhouse mirror of Bard College. "Oh, I guess that must be the admission decision and maybe financial aid stuff." My mother pointed only to the most obvious things as indicators of good news. "Yes, it's a big envelope, so big. That's good news. I know it." Classic mom. "It doesn't mean anything, Mom." I tore the edge without fanfare. "Congratulations, blah, blah, blah. Welcome to Bard College, blah, blah, blah." I had gotten in. "Dad, how much is Penn State?"
About $5,000. How much did you get from Bard College? What will it cost? Well, I looked at the numbers and various line items. I got accepted. It costs about $20,000 a year, but they gave me $15,000 in aid, so it's going to be the same as Penn State? I didn't dare to say it as a declarative statement. Really? That's good news for you. I guess you'll have to decide between Bard College and Penn State. Bard had granted me the top 10 scholarship, even though I was 14th in my class. Some group, somewhere, some committee, had decided that I was worth it. I was graduating and would attend Bard. I was going to speak at graduation. And with a few weeks of school left, I was going to make it. For a moment, I felt great. I got to school the next day, and a different group decided that I was not great. When the morning bus spewed me forth into the parking lot, I was met by a phalanx of the auto shop kids. Grease, denim, bullets. Travis stood at their fore and brandished his cigarette pack. Travis and I caught each other's eye. We hadn't had any scrapes since middle school and had reached an unspoken détente. But maybe he felt that our time was slipping away, that he had a narrowing window to be a dick to me. Once more, for old time's sake. Travis looked right at me.
Hey, go back to Nam, you fucking freak!
Guffaws ensued, hand slapping and high fives. I stared at them all.
Fuck you.
Both of my middle fingers, for the hearing impaired. They fired back.
No, fuck you, you fucking gook.
More guffaws. It was 7:45 a.m., and all the other kids in my bus procession pretended not to hear our exchange, even though it echoed across the lot. Travis's announcement in the parking lot brought me back to reality. With the leaden weight of gook slung around my neck, I was dragged back in my place at the familiar bottom, back to Nam. It didn't matter that I was going to speak at graduation, or going to Bard, or that I was on the prom court, or any of that crap. I had felt an uneasiness at the top, an unfamiliarity. I knew what the bottom felt like. I was still, shocking even to myself, a gook no matter how hard I tried not to be. Their admissions committee had decided. Outnumbered, I stormed off to meet up with my crew, my face burning hot and my eyes welling. I had been humiliated in front of everyone in the parking lot. While the other kids had ignored Travis's insults, there was no way that they hadn't heard them. I felt a sharp and white pain like never before. This was the pain of the fall. I had just been celebrated, supposedly, by everyone, and in less than a day, I had been belittled in front of everyone. When I got to our meeting spot, I was enraged. I had snapped, and my wounded ego was now just blindingly inflamed. The feeling of belonging, the feeling of being loved, capsized, its flimsiness all too apparent. Could you sink a whole ship with one hole? Apparently, you could. My fears and insecurities weighed so much heavier than anyone's love and light. Liam, Nate, Stephen, and a few others were milling around. I threw my bag down. Fucking Travis. Fuck him. I'm going to fight him right now. Can you guys come and get my back? Make sure none of his friends jump me? Everyone stood up without hesitation, as I knew they would. What happened? Nate asked. I got off the bus. Fucking Travis yelled out, "Go back to Nam," and called me a gook. Fuck him. I'm going to fucking kick his teeth in. Liam, who was always down for a fight, strangely spoke up against my plan. You can't fight Travis, Hook. I shook my head. I'm not letting this bullshit go and let him think he can get away with it. If I don't do anything now, as a senior, what does that say? What does that look like? Fucking bullshit. I started to head toward Travis and his chain-smoking ash-hole friends. Nate grabbed my arm and held me in place. Liam is right. You do this, and for what? You know what'll happen. He and Liam were referring to our school's draconian fight policy. If you were caught fighting at Carlisle High School, you were automatically suspended for 2 weeks. All school assignments given to you during those 2 weeks were recorded as a zero. The net effect was that you would fail most, if not all, your classes for that grading period with a 2-week suspension. Thanks, Reaganomics and your zero-tolerance policing. I did know the policy, but my fury overpowered any reasonable assessment of the insult and a measured response. I wasn't going to write another editorial. Words were a useless currency in this exchange of pejoratives and blows. I didn't care about suspension, failing, or college. In that moment, I only felt hurt and angry, humiliated and defeated. Nate held me in place. Liam and Steven lined up behind. "Listen, you're going to graduate soon. Don't fuck that up. Travis is an asshole. Always has been." He paused for a second and thought aloud. "What the fuck am I doing? I'm going to summer school again as it is. Where is Travis?" I understood the gravity of what he was suggesting. Nate was going to fight Travis for me. "He's at the bus drop," I told him, stunned. "Okay. Nobody come with me. You guys will be late for class. I'll take care of this. See you tomorrow, maybe." Nate sped off, and Liam and Byron kept me from following him. The seriousness of Nate's act unfolded on me. I felt buoyed by Nate's selfless, kind, and loyal gesture. I vacillated between my still surging rage for Travis and my disbelief at Nate's sacrifice. Even after the bell rang for first period, I chose a table by the window, straining to see if maybe Nate had managed to get away or to not even fight Travis. He was a good friend. No, he was a great friend. We didn't see Nate or Travis for the rest of the week. I didn't call Nate. He lived with his grandparents and they never answered their house phone. But Liam confirmed for me that they had both been suspended from school. Ironically, Nate wasn't grounded by his grandparents because he had told them that he fought Travis in defense, leaving out in whose defense he fought. It was just another fight, and no one in our crew gave Nate's suspension more thought other than an added caginess around the auto shop kids in case they decided to retaliate. But for me, Nate's fight was so much more than a typical fight between punks and rednecks. He was willing to literally take a hit for me so that I wouldn't fail my classes or get suspended. Nate saved my graduation and graduation speech. Because of him, my moment of greatness in front of our school still awaited me. I saw Nate that weekend at a party. I didn't have the right words to thank him for keeping me from failing classes and torpedoing my future in a senseless fit of rage. It was the loyalty and kinship that had kept us together as a crew. And in the fading weeks of our senior year, that iron-forged kinship glowed as bright as it ever did. At the party, I patted him on the shoulder. "Dude, thank you." It was Nate's Aristeia, and I had failed him as his bard, unable to better herald his greatness. June, 1991. My father stood at my bedroom door.
"You're cleaning up your room? That's good. Geez, that's a lot of books on the floor. You're picking them up?"
"Obviously. I mean, they're going to take a picture and stuff." The Carlisle Sentinel was sending a reporter to interview me for a profile that our town's paper was doing on area high school seniors.
"Why are they interviewing you? Tell me again. Did you do something special?"
"Jesus, Dad, for the last time, I don't know. They contacted the high school to ask for a list of kids to interview, and someone gave the Sentinel my name. Maybe it's because I'm the school paper editor, or a graduation speaker, or I don't know."
"You don't have to be so emotional about it. I was just asking a question. And don't take the Lord's name in vain."
"Forget it. Let me finish picking things up, okay?" The reporter, a 30-something man named Dan Miller, came by at noon. My mother asked him 4 times if he wanted tea, and my father hovered around awkwardly in the kitchen, while Dan and I talked in the living room. Dan asked me about my love of art and literature, who nurtured my passions, what my future plans were. I kept my parents sequestered as much as possible, worried that my mother might say something stupid and/or unintelligible, and that my father would say that he figured I wouldn't amount to much because of my interest in literature and art, and not in a practical degree like engineering. Finally, with my father unable to give us any berth of privacy, Dan asked him, "So Chan, tell us what little Fook was like. Any good stories?" I held my breath but could feel myself recoiling, bracing myself for my father to say something backhanded or embarrassing. My father smiled as I had never seen before, his eyes lighting up. He was unrecognizable. "Most strange. My father said my name not as we Vietnamesed it in our house, Phop, but as it was Americanized, Phuc."
"Oh, Phuc. He loved books even as a little kid. When we lived in Saigon, his favorite thing was to look at books, and if you turned a picture book upside down, he would scream and turn it around again. So smart. He was only 1 year old, and he knew when a book was upside down. And when we came to Carlisle, we took him to the library so much and read him so many books. For his good English, you know."
I was speechless. A warmth, a latent pride, exuded from my father's recollections of me as a child while he recounted my passion for reading at an early age. In his exuberance, I was surprisingly hurt, stung by its dormancy and now sudden awakening. Where was this warmth, this pride, for the last few years of high school? Where was it even 5 minutes ago? Was he trotting out his pride in me because there was a stranger in the house and he was trying to save face? Or did my father really feel this way? I felt embarrassed and confused, uneasy from his praise and attention, feeling the tension of our relationship crack with his heartfelt recollections of my childhood. A blinding flash went off in the corner of my eye. My father had taken a camera out and snapped a picture of me and Dan, punctuating his reminiscence with a paparazzi pop of the camera flash.
"Say chi! This is a special day," he cried out.
This, from the man who had earlier been privately grilling me about why anyone would want to interview me, but was now publicly my number one fan. With the flash still in our eyes, I suggested that we move to my bedroom to talk uninterrupted. Dan looked at my Smiths posters, my walls redecorated with random collages of pictures cut out from magazines, and my collection of discarded library books. Eyeing my shelves, he said, "Tell me about these books. It's unusual to see so many books in a teenager's room." "Oh, I discovered that I really love literature." That was absolutely true, but I wasn't going to tell him that I started reading books to sound smart. "I love connecting with people over great books. It bypasses the superficial stuff, the stuff that divides us. I interviewed your English teacher, Mrs. Ferguson, earlier this week. She said that you are the best read student she's ever taught."
"She did? Really?"
I was surprised to hear that, since she had never said it to me.
"That's nice. She's a great teacher. I've been so lucky to have so many great teachers, Mrs. Krebs, Ms. Ganster."
"You said you'll want to teach someday?"
"Definitely. Once, when we had a sub for AP European History, Ms. Ganster told the sub to have me teach the class. Left me the lesson plans and everything. Oh man, I loved teaching. Sharing something I love with the class. But I love school and the classroom. It's where I'm happiest. I'd like to get a PhD in literature, teach at the college level. But I love art too, painting."
"So you'll have to decide between those things?"
I pushed back.
"Why?
I love art and literature so much. Why do I have to decide on only one?"
I felt this pressure to sacrifice one for the other, and I hated it. If I had the vitality to pursue both things, who was going to make me choose only one? Dan was jotting down my answers, and the interview by our town's newspaper felt like an acknowledgement of me, of my greatness. No one made Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo choose between painting and sculpture and engineering and architecture. Why can't I be a Renaissance man as well? Dan smiled and scribbled into his notebook.
"Ah, that's great. A modern-day Renaissance man."
I didn't flinch.
"Yes."
"That's quite ambitious."
"That's the whole point, right? I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to achieve it, but those are my passions and I have to try. I mean, I got Scholastic Gold Keys for art and writing this year, so academically, no one is telling me to stop either one.
There's a whole world out there of people telling you what you can't do or who you can't be. That's the world I live in. And who are those people who think they know me and know who I can be? And why do they care? There's only what I do and how hard I work at being great at it. That's all there is for me, because no matter what I do, to some people, I'll only be... I stopped myself from filling in the blank because it felt corrosive. I could feel the insult of Travis and his assholes still eating away at me, and I wanted to focus on the positive, shifting the topic to being a graduation speaker. Dan didn't push me on my line of thought and allowed me to trail off. Instead, he moved on to ask me about my family, our journey to Carlisle, my plans for college. We talked a lot about our favorite books, bands, movies. I ended the interview by complaining about modern poetry, especially E.E. Cummings, and free jazz. He thanked me and my parents for our time and said that the article would run the following weekend right after commencement. The Carlisle Sentinel had documented the trans, for better and worse, over the last 15 years. From our arrival in 1975, the follow-up article chronicling Ombanoi's arrival as boat people, to the fire that killed my great-grandmother and my uncle's murder-suicide. I would not have named those events as highlights for our family, but here I was, garnering some acclaim because of my accomplishments, not because of tragedy or infamy or history. If I had anything to say about my aspirations, anything about my personal goals, I was going to say them aloud, in print, for the whole world to see, to show people that I was striving for greatness. I wasn't going to be defined by a war or race or my family's story. Holding forth to the reporter with equal parts insecurity and arrogance, as if they were so different. I was a Renaissance man, I declared. I didn't know if I would achieve those goals, but that was the very nature of having goals. They were aspirational, hopeful, not predictive. The potential for failure did not lower my hopes. My hopes were pinned and melted to my waxy dreams, soaring upward. After the interview, I sunned myself in the warm public recognition of my Aristeia. But when I read the article a week later, I knew I had soared too high. I felt profoundly embarrassed. I cringed at my public hubris and arrogance for comparing myself to Renaissance greats, for believing that I had anything worthwhile to say as a 17-year-old. In my mind, I was an Achilles, but in the harsh light of my local newspaper, in the blinding black and white of print, I saw that I had behaved like an Agamemnon. My aspirations for greatness were the antithesis of punk, and I knew it. And for the first time, I realized that the most punk thing for me to do was to be who I was without pretension or preamble or grandiose posturing. I had read it in Nietzsche, but I didn't know what it really meant. Become who you are. But becoming who you are required throwing away who you thought you were, unloading expectations both internal and external. In this mindset of unburdening myself, as the horizon line of graduation drew nearer, I thought about the fresh start of college in 3 months. No one would know me. No one would have preconceived notions of who I was. No one would know my family or our history. They would only know what I told them. Who was I, anyway? I had spent all this time trying to figure out who I should be for acceptance, for protection, for prestige. When the graduation speakers met to choose a theme, I was still feeling wounded from the whole Travis incident. Wounded because everything was for naught. I had tried so hard to fit in at school, establish myself inside and outside of the classroom, and the effort had been rendered pointless for me. There would always be kids and adults out there in the audience looking at me and thinking whatever horrible shit they wanted. And I cared about what people thought, but I felt too pained to say that I did. I wanted to throw it all away, to leave everything behind, all the emotional baggage, and to start over. In the speakers' meeting, I impertinently suggested baggage or luggage as our theme. In response to the other kids' cliché-suggested themes of the future or our hopes. And the group improbably agreed. The theme for graduation speeches would be luggage. It was time to get rid of my emotional baggage. June 5th, 1991. Graduation night. In keeping with Carlisle High School tradition, the boys and girls wore the green and white of our school's colors, boys in green and girls in white. The National Honor Society students got an additional golden stole that draped our shoulders, a visual distinction from our rank-and-file classmates. I was the only one in my crew wearing one. Liam and Byron flipped the stole in my face before shaking my hand warmly. "Way to go, Fookster! We're stoked for your speech." "Thanks. We made it, guys. We fucking made it." They whooped, and no one mentioned Nate, who had been permanently expelled for shaving "suck it" into the back of his head and would not graduate with us. In my pocket, I had my speech folded up and damp. We were all sweating under our polyester gowns, and Mr. Drake vigilantly watched us to make sure that no one inflated a beach ball or did anything to puncture the grandeur of the processions. A stage had been erected in the middle of the football stadium at the 50-yard line. Early concerns about a late afternoon thunderstorm dissipated, and the low front had moved on, leaving clear skies and a muggy warm glow over the end zone as we lined up at 7 p.m. Parents, friends, teachers, well-wishers gathered in the aluminum bleachers, clanging around to find seats. Lou sat with my parents and both sets of grandparents. Molly sat with some of her friends. I could see Mrs. Krebs, Mrs. Ferguson, and Mr. Shirk, my favorite art teacher, and most of the high school faculty. Jacob Royal, our valedictorian, Elizabeth Rusek, our class president, and the four graduation speakers led the procession, taking our seats nearest the stage. I fingered the corner of my speech back and forth, looking out at the sea of waves and smiles. In the days leading up to graduation, I worked with Mrs. Krebs on the speech. She had asked me how I was feeling about graduation and what I wanted to say to my classmates. Her advice was to say how I was feeling, but truthfully, I was not feeling my greatness. I was thankful that I had survived high school, but I didn't think that my teachers or peers wanted to hear me say that. At the end of high school, I was exhausted, frustrated, and angry that I had spent so much of my time in Carlisle trying to be seen, understood, and accepted, and I just wanted to forget it all. I was done rolling the boulder up the hill. I knew that my real feelings wouldn't fulfill the expected celebratory tone of a graduation speech, so I told her I wanted to write a speech about souvenirs, and she agreed to it. And now, it was graduation. National anthem on a trumpet, welcoming address, Elizabeth's introductory remarks. The other speakers gave their 5-minute addresses, and we all clapped. Mr. Drake read my name out. "Fook Tran." I mounted the stage and took the microphone. The early evening lowered a deep indigo over us all, and the stadium lights had buzzed on with a fluorescent fanfare. I could still make out the bleachers, but the audience was blurry and indistinguishable. My classmates clapped as I approached the mic, and I heard Liam yell out, "Yeah, Fookster," which caught a fiery glare from Mr. Drake. I took a breath and leaned into the microphone. I wanted to prime my audience for the imagery to follow, so I started out with some jokes about souvenirs and waited for the laughter to subside, knowing that I had begun with some easy and disarming humor. That was my universal defense, but I was going to turn it on its side now. "Anyway, I guess most of us buy souvenirs to bring back the memories that are associated with them, and I think that's okay. But here is a thought that I don't think everyone has thought. What are you going to do when you become senile and can't remember where New York City is, much less why you have 20 commemorative statuettes of Liberty? Let's face it, we can only accumulate so many commemorative things." Was I holding on to things, having forgotten why I had them in the first place? I looked at my friends, seated down below to my left, my crew, my classmates, lab partners, quiz bowl teammates, yearbook staff, newspaper staff. They would only be with me if I remembered them. I just never understood the logic behind buying souvenirs. After all, it's the memory we want, not the souvenir. And once the memory goes, what meaning does the souvenir have? That's like keeping training wheels on your bicycle. I think most of us spend far too much time looking back at our past anyway and not worrying enough about the future. Without an attic full of old prom dresses, dried corsages, books, toys you don't play with anymore, and photo albums of pictures we had thought were long gone. I looked out to the bleachers and wondered if my parents understood that part. My parents had fled from a place too painful to remember, yet too precious to forget. They had lugged around old photos that they never looked at but couldn't bear to throw away until the flood. My family didn't have old prom dresses or corsages. We came with nothing. My toys had been thrown away long ago. My classmates had basements and attics full of heirlooms, bronzed baby shoes, treasure boxes full of firsts. I only had my story, but none of it sounded like their stories. I wondered, how would my classmates have reacted if I had told them about my real experiences? Who would believe me if I gave a speech about my father trying to kill me because I didn't make honor roll? Who would care if I told them about how I tried to change my name to Peter because I wanted to fit in? Who would be able to relate to me if I told them about my family's harrowing escape from Saigon? Leave your souvenirs behind, the ones of Carlisle, the ones of the beach, the ones of your friends. Put away your yearbooks, hide your seashells, and forget the pictures, because if these things mean nearly as much as you say they mean, you'll never forget them. I don't need souvenirs, and I don't want souvenirs. None of you need souvenirs either. As long as you laugh, won't you carry all the good times with you? And as long as you cry, won't you carry all the bad times with you? So, wherever we all end up, and wherever we are all going, I know we don't need souvenirs, because laughter will always be laughter, and tears will always be tears. I stepped away from the microphone to signal the end, making sure the last word, tears, could ring out. That was my final word, tears. I had planned not to say thank you at the end of the speech, thinking that its omission would be a small, symbolic gesture that I wasn't the typically thankful, gracious immigrant. But I slipped up and reflexively said it anyway. Thank you! So fucking Pavlovian and contradictory. Clapping, singing from the chorus, hats in the air. I sighed. It was over. My parents and grandparents had made a late buffet dinner at our house after the ceremony, and my mother had printed out a giant dot matrix banner that had a 16-bit illustration of a graduation cap and the words, "Congratulations, FOP." My father shook my hand and said, "Good job." And my mother told me that she thought my voice sounded nice on the PA speakers. What else could they have said about the speech? Banoy reached up and pinched my cheek, Vietnamesing, "You did a great job. That sounded so nice. But you know I have no idea what you said." She cackled at the joke / not joke and handed me a red and gold envelope with a crisp $50 bill in it. "Thanks anyway, Banoy." I kissed her on the cheek before she went to everyone at the dining room table. My parents and both sets of grandparents hadn't been together in years, and they were equally happy to catch up with one another. I shoveled some egg rolls and rice vermicelli into my mouth and took the earliest opportunity to excuse myself. I changed my clothes and took our car to pick up Molly at her house. She slid into the front seat. "Hey, Mr. Graduation Speaker. Nice job. That was great." "Oh, thanks." I was super nervous. "It was great, really." "Thanks, really." "So, there's a graduation party at Scully's apartment, and there's a party at Derek Linker's that we should go to. Those are the only parties I know about. Seem okay to you?" "Yeah, of course. It's your graduation night. We do what you want." We showed up at Scully's dank apartment downtown and found graduation mayhem. kegs, weed, a giant American flag hung in the living room. I took a few celebratory hits from a bong, and we laughed about the improbability of Liam having actually graduated. After an hour, we left to go to Derek's house, a grand suburban home. His parents were both physicians. Derek and I were in AP Calculus, and we'd been in school together since Moreland Elementary. Kids milling around, watching TV, and fishing their fingers in the Chex Mix to reel in their favorite bits. Juice mixed with ginger ale in giant crystal punch bowls. The opposite of mayhem. Ho-hum. Still high, I leaned over to Molly, who smiled with equanimity in both polarizing expeditions. Hey, wanna just go to the All-American? Gravy fries and coffee? Really? That's what you wanna do? She shook her head. Yeah, kind of. We left the party. In the car, in honor of graduation, I ironically played Depeche Mode's Black Celebration. I did want to go to the truck stop to eat gravy fries and drink coffee. I had recently read The Fountainhead and was still ruminating over its themes. I didn't know much else about Ayn Rand, but was so eager to talk about the book with Molly. Just another Friday night of spirited literary critique. I started telling her about it, but paused as we pulled into the truck stop diner. Glowing with tubes of neon, sparkling with chrome, the All-American truck stop on Route 11 was a garish sight that was familiar and comforting to me. Our favorite of all the truck stops along the I-81 and I-76 corridors. After late nights partying, after punk shows, after driving around aimlessly, my friends and I had eaten, puked, and passed out in its maroon vinyl booths for the last 4 years of high school. The All-Americans' waitresses were direct, surly, and fast. The truck drivers, weary from miles at the wheel, filled the booths. It seemed fitting to celebrate at the truck stop on my graduation night, the eternal returns on an endless stretch of country highway. As the hostess led me and Molly to a booth, we passed exhausted truckers too tired to look up as they ate their breakfast, lunch, or dinner, all of it served with the ambrosia of coffee. What'll you have, sweetheart? The word sweetheart never sounded so world-weary. Fries with gravy on the side, brown gravy, please, and 2 cups of coffee, black, thank you. As we waited for our fries, sipping on our coffees, encased in red and silver and the low chatter of interstate stories, I plinked a quarter in the tableside jukebox. It was our game at the All-American to play the most annoying country or classic rock song, and we were well-versed in Dolly, Loretta, Merle, ELO, and Elton. But you didn't pick a good Elton John song like Tiny Dancer. You picked an annoying one like Crocodile Rock. I flipped the lever at the top of the jukebox and froze. No fucking way. They have R.E.M.? The tiny placard trumpeted R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion. I had never thought I would ever, in the course of a million plates of fries and cups of coffee, see R.E.M. on the truck stop jukebox, but there they were. R.E.M. had a hit record that spring of 1991, and Losing My Religion played everywhere, radio, MTV, blaring from random cars in the middle of Carlisle. Gone were the days of my bootleg cassettes of Reckoning and Chronic Town. Good for them, I guess. They had made it. As the song's mandolins started up, I grumbled about sellouts and corporate rock, sipping my first cup of coffee. Molly squared herself to me at the table, leaned in over her coffee. So, how's it feel to graduate? You did it, Mr. Carlisle High School graduate. And you gave a great speech. Oh, I don't know about that. It was okay. I messed it up a little for my nerves, I guess. I feel weirdly let down. So much hype around everything, you know? I reflexively shrugged at Molly's compliment, deflecting praise as I always did because I was so unaccustomed to hearing earnest accolades. Any kind remark made me feel vulnerable, forced me to confront myself and my purported excellence, a task that felt impossible and undeserved. The fall from Travis's insult had apparently kept me grounded, pinned me down. She shook her head. Well, I thought it was great, and it seemed like your family was proud of you. I scrunched my face. Seriously? My family? You don't really know my parents, and I doubt they knew what I was talking about anyway. So if they were proud, they didn't know what they were proud of. Molly pushed back against my dismissiveness. But your grandparents were all there, all four of them. That was nice to see them all, right? Your dad's parents drove all the way from Oklahoma? That seems like a big deal. It is a big deal, but... I paused as our order of fries landed on the tabletop with a clatter, followed by a small bowl of steaming rich gravy. But what? It's not enough for your family to show up and cheer for you? Molly nibbled on the still too hot fries. I guess it is. I plunged my fries into the gravy and thought about what Molly said, then changed my mind. Actually, no. No, it isn't. It's not enough for me to have them just show up. I worked really hard on the speech, and I don't think that they understood any of it. Okay, maybe my dad did a little, but it sucks that they didn't really get it. It sucks that my grandparents and my mom don't know enough English to get it, and my dad doesn't really know enough about the idea of metaphors and symbolism to get it, never mind my high school experience. And Lou? He's in 9th grade, so he doesn't get it yet either. I'm bummed that they don't get it, because it confirms that they really don't understand me. Molly shook her head. But you've always said that your family didn't get you. How is this new to you? I know. But now that we're talking about it, really talking, I guess I had always secretly hoped that it wasn't true. I did want them to understand me because they're my family. It feels good to be understood, and I imagine that it would feel really good to be understood by your family because they've got the most mileage with you. They made you. But I don't know what that understanding is like. But they still could connect with you, right? Someday? It sounds like you're writing them off. I shook my head at her suggestion. I suppose that they could change, that they could come around and know me as a person. But I'm about to go to college. We're not going to write each other letters. I mean, they still don't understand why I want to major in English and art, and I can't explain it to them in a way that they'll get it. I feel like the door is closing on me and my parents, and this is as good as it's going to be, my relationship with them. They literally can't understand me because my Vietnamese sucks as much as their English, and there's a cultural and generational barrier, frankly, and who knows what else. I was cratered by a deep sadness at this realization that I hadn't expressed before. The barriers felt insurmountable, each of us alone on our sides. My heart ached with the thought. The song had ended, and I ordered a second coffee. Molly was always so optimistic, circling back to the beginning. Well, to my original point, I thought the speech was great, and other people thought it was great too, so that's gotta be something. That recognition must have felt good. It did, I conceded her point, still pained by the idea that my parents and grandparents sat in the audience with hardly a clue as to what I had said, while total strangers understood every word, even if they didn't understand the intent. At my most public, my most exposed, I felt most alone. Yeah, it was nice that people applauded. I thought the speech and graduation were going to be this big, triumphant moment of greatness, but it wasn't. It was a weird mix of different feelings and expectations. But I see what you're saying. The audience liked it. Maybe most of my classmates liked it. Good for me. Ugh. I don't mean to sound like an unappreciative asshole. I trailed off, wanting to pivot from my melancholy, which was squeezing itself, uninvited, into our celebratory booth. I looked around at the truck stop diner and its patrons, and a revelation lighted upon me, pushing off my unwelcome gloom. I surveyed everyone under the diner's fluorescent glow. You know something? You and I, we have something in common with these truckers. Molly laughed. Oh, really? Are we done psychoanalyzing you and your family? We've moved on to ourselves and the truckers? Well, I'm pretty sure neither of us have beards or know how to drive an 18-wheeler. No, seriously. You know, for the last 4 years, my friends and I chose the All-American Diner because we thought it was funny to come here and mingle with redneck truckers at 1 a.m. I mean, we wouldn't openly fuck with them. but we'd laugh at how they stared at us or shook their heads. But I realize something now. What's that? Teenagers and truck drivers, we're all on our way to somewhere else. We're all sitting here at these booths, knowing that we're not at our final destination. This is not the last stop for any of us. We're all en route to far-off places, but our arrival? Who knows? Our arrival will be dictated by things we both can and can't control, unforeseen things. I'm going to college to study English and art, but who knows if that'll happen? Connor's joined the army, but what if he gets killed in Iraq? What about you or my brother? What's next? And we might get to our destination directly, but maybe it'll be in a roundabout, crazy way. Molly nodded. Interesting point. As she slid a quarter into the jukebox and clicked through the song selector, I mulled over the living metaphor of sitting at the truck stop, waiting to get on the road, longing to see Carlisle in my rear view, to look out at an unexplored horizon, the past in a mirror, the future in a window, the present behind the wheel. The rural highway of Route 11 outside the truck stop brought me back to the beginning, back to our beginning in Carlisle. One of my earliest memories flickered in my mind. My parents, me, and Lou, joyriding in the first car we owned, the sage green Pontiac. My parents would take us out on Route 174, a long, narrow stretch of hilly swells surrounded by high corn and lowing cows. Lou and I would lie on the back seat, unbuckled, as my father pinned the accelerator. We crested over the hills, the engine rattling and wheezing, and Lou and I would go flying in the air as the car rocketed for a moment, hovering with an aerial magic, before crunching back down. In the back seat, we lurched upward and then collapsed into the upholstery, banging our elbows and knees, laughing hysterically, and begging him to go faster over the next hill. When we reached Shippensburg, he'd turn the car around and we'd drive back faster, flying higher than before. In Carlisle, we cried out to do it again, and the car turned around and roared down the road, all of us exhilarated and cheering from the simple, brief pleasure of driving on a country road with nowhere to go and nothing to do. I smiled at the recollection, waiting for Molly to pick a song for our soundtrack. From the diner booth, I squinted at the glorious, blinding lights of Carlisle's famous truck stop. Its Olympian-sized eagle, shining red, white, and blue, loomed over us, and in the glass, I saw two images simultaneously, myself reflected in the diner window, and the star-spangled sign soaring aloft in the night air, pointing the way, winking at me again and again. All American, all American, all American. Acknowledgements. I want to give my deepest, undying thanks to so many people who have cheered me on in this memoir writing process. Who does this writing thing for a living? Good God, you writers are amazing. Writing the book has been an incredible, challenging, and rewarding journey, and I am immeasurably grateful to all my literary Sherpas who pushed, dragged, and portaged my ass up the mountain. I feel humbled and so very lucky. Sue Tran, where do I even begin? You've read every single word I've written 100 times over. Your keen insights and sensitive reading of every sentence, paragraph, and chapter made my writing and book better. And beyond your literary prowess, you soldiered on alone on weekends with nary a complaint while I hid myself away to write and edit. The kids were dressed, fed, and cleaned. The laundry was done, dinner was cooked. All this happened while I sat on my ass, writing and psychoanalyzing my childhood. You're the Mary to my George Bailey. Thanks for finding me in this wonderful life. I love you more than my words can express, but I will spend the rest of my life trying to tell you. Sarah Levitt, you get all the credit for ferreting me out from under my teaching and tattooing and motorcycle riding. You saw something that was worth saying to the world, and from day one, you've understood me and how I wanted to tell my story. Your patience and cheerleading have propelled me and kept me focused. As the card says, you're fucking awesome. And it's your fault that my Honda CB350 restoration is still unfinished. Now, can I go back to working on it? Jasmine Faustino, thank you so much for your eagle-eyed edits, patience with my schedule, and your boot camp approach to my flabby, wide-ranging story. You gave my book its beach bod with your love and enthusiasm. I appreciate so much that we have a shared experience and common touchstones, and I can't imagine anyone else who would have teased out the threads of the story as you've done. So how about that tattoo of yours? Thanks to everyone at Flatiron Books for your patience, precision, and professionalism, especially Bryn Clark, Christopher Smith, and Ellen Pyle. Oh, can I see another version of this? How about now? No, move this. Can we make it look more punk rock looking? Good grief. You were nice about it all. Lou Tran, you were the first person who ever said to me, you should write a book. And I laughed at you for like 10 minutes. Yeah, right. Thanks for believing in me and for being the Chewbacca to my Han. It could not have been easy to be my brother, but you've borne it with grace and kindness. Maybe it wasn't all terrible? There's a reason that you're the hero in my story. We've clocked long miles together, and hopefully we have many more. Time to rent that RV, and we still have a motorcycle trip to take. Chan and Chi Tran. Mom and Dad, we all did our best, and I know that you tried. I know that the book's complexity might be lost on you, but I want you to know that I am grateful for the sacrifices that you both made. They are immeasurable, and I know that you did it for me and Lou. Lewis Robinson, Seth Rigoletti, and Taffy Field. You guys had no reason to be so excited about and supportive of my writing, but you all were unfailingly full of enthusiasm and love for me. Lewis, remember when you had the flu and still let me come over at 9 p.m. to talk to you about some New York agent, Sarah, who had emailed about representing me? And then you asked me to be on your writing podcast long before I was writing anything. You knew before I knew. Seth, you wanted to hear my story before I wanted to tell it, and every time I said some bullshit or deflected, you called me on it. I've admired and emulated your vulnerability and honesty. Taffy, my favorite colleague, your unending efforts to be a better human being have inspired me. It's been a highlight of my career to teach with and learn from you. Team Large, y'all are the best book club ever. Thanks for the lively conversations and good cheer at every chapter. Please don't choose my memoir to read for book club. Paula Chu, thanks for being my Yoda. Your deep wisdom, humor, and empathy have changed me profoundly and for the better. That change made possible the writing of this book, the dredging up of a lot of sad and painful memories. All my teachers, but especially Jane Krebs, Loreen Ganster, Sue Hench, Marcia Menser, Jim Shirk, Robert Moyer, Michael O'Hara. You cultivated the best that you saw in me with your gentle and firm teaching. You endured my full-sail pissy adolescence, arrogance, anger, moodiness, and depression with such love and empathy. I became a teacher because of you all, and I can only hope that I've been half the teacher that you are. My crew, you guys saved my life. What a crazy high school experience it was. RIP our friends who didn't live long enough to see that it could get better. Because of the book's focus, so many people, stories, and relationships ended up on the cutting room floor. You know who you are. Long drives, Shakespeare troupe rehearsals, hikes in the woods, cemetery walks, endless phone conversations. I just didn't have room to get it all in there, and I'm saddened that I wasn't able to tell the world how much you meant to me. But to me, you meant the world. So much love to Josh Painter, Julie Foliano, Rick Lloyd, Val White, Sonia Tomlinson, and Jay Merritt. I start the new year with you all, and you set the benchmark for joy, laughter, and friendship. Adam Burke and the TEDx Dirigo team, thanks for taking a chance on my crazy idea for a TEDx talk. Brendan Whitney, rest in power. We all miss and love you, buddy. To all my aunts and uncles and cousins, the Wu Tran clan, You all were that proverbial village that it took to raise a roughneck like me, and you kept me close and loved me at my most unlovable. Special thanks to my aunts, Go Hai, Go Tu, Go Sao, and Go Bai. You're the best. In telling my story, I realize how much I want to hear yours, and I hope that we have the time. I'm all ears. Last, but certainly not least, Phoebe Tran and Beatrix Tran, you're 5 and 8 at this writing. I'll try to control my dread when you read this book. You cannot read this book until you're 16. I hope that you can see me as a person who had many struggles and persevered, all while seeing humor and beauty in the world and drawing strength from my friends, family, and teachers. I was a teenager once too, and not the overbearing, protective, and sarcastic person that I am now. Well, I was always sarcastic. And probably overbearing too. I was not always protective, but I didn't have anything I wanted to protect until you were born. You girls make me want to be the best version of myself, and I fail every day. But every day, I try again. I love you both so much. Thanks for letting me be your father. This is Phuc Tran. Thank you for listening to Saigon, a Macmillan audio production from Flatiron Books. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos, recorded by James Kerwood. Text copyright 2020 by Phuc Tran. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.